I'm HRN's Communications Director, Kat Johnson, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in Three.
I think we should realize that we more or less have a broken food system. When 800 million of us go to bed hungry, 600 million are obese, we waste 30% of our food, then something is fundamentally wrong.
We'll introduce you to one food waste solution happening in Asia.
They introduced this system where residents were issued an electronic ID card that would open an automated bin and enable them to weigh the food waste being dropped off. And then they would be charged, you know, in a certain amount of money for the weight of that food.
And we'll take a look at some of the real struggles happening closer to home.
How is it possible that a meal that was perfectly fine to consume at 10:59 p.m. then becomes waste at 11 p.m.
So tune in to this week's Meat in 3 on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
All right. This is your host, Patrick Martins, and your sponsor of the show, Patrick Martins of Heritage Foods. Man, we have got a holy grail of guests today. We have got a really interesting group today. It's like I said, I'm Patrick Martins. This is the main course, the first show to ever air on the Heritage Radio Network back in 2009. So, and that was actually the first song ever aired on Heritage Radio Network, Rocket 88. So this is very exciting. We have to get right into it because we have too much talent in here. I'm Patrick. I see Emily, the point guard, Emily Pearson.
Good morning.
And also the sponsor of today's show. Then I see Janice Acevedo.
Acevedo, good morning.
Hello, thanks for coming. Then the old horse of Bread and Life, Al Diefenbach. Hey, Al.
Whoa, good morning.
Nice. Then we got Mike Edison, unfortunately. No, just kidding.
Good morning. I'd like to be called Brother Mike, though, just for today.
Brother Mike, that's fine. And now true sister, Caroline Tweedy, the executive director of Bread and Life.
So I'm the Holy Grail.
You're the Holy Grail. You are the replacement for our beloved Tony Butler, who's also on the board of Heritage Radio. And then we have Chef Millicent Cerise.
Not the Holy Grail.
Not the Holy Grail. Very nice. So, wow, we love St. John's Bread and Life, the largest hunger relief organization in the borough, one of the biggest in the country. So take it away, Ems.
Well, you forgot my good friend, Brandon Hoy.
Oh, my God. Brandon Hoy. Sorry.
Our co-host and
I'm
the owner
nervous.
Of Roberta's.
I'm definitely leaving now, so that's it. Pretty much, he's ruined it. But I mean, it is kind of awkward because I'm sitting directly behind him.
Know.
But he should have known by the soft back rub that I was here.
And also, we have Sado Di Liberto, one of the great anchovy producers in all the world, and he is in town for 1 week to make pasta for the Heritage Foods team.
I'd like to say I don't really trust people who don't like anchovies.
Right, thank you.
As I don't like people who don't like Elvis Presley either.
All right, so take it away.
Brandon might have exited the studio. Also, Saro, ciao. Good morning. Anyway, so Patrick took my whole job. He gave all your titles. He introduced you. We have a packed house. We're really excited. So I'm going to jump right in to the weekly based, which is our segment. We're going to talk some news of the week. So first of all, Halloween is upon us. Candy, decorations, costumes, Carroll Gardens, Cobble Hill. Where are we all trick-or-treating? What are we eating?
Do you know there's not one documented instance of a razor blade actually being in an apple? And I'm trying to change that this year.
Oh, stop.
Mike sent me a terrifying picture
You're
yesterday.
Going to hell.
Mike sent me a picture of a bag of apples with a razor blade on top. Well, he had just
been
to the
required.
Hardware store.
You are the one everybody's afraid of.
I believe Halloween should be scary. You know, I hate it when like people come dresses, princesses, except the men, of course, but astronauts, cowboys, baseball players. That's for the rest of the year. I want to see zombies. I want to see, like, murdered prom queens. I want to see Freddy and Jason, Frankenstein. I really believe
Janice
Halloween
told me
is
her
scary,
son.
Dave. Very scary.
Janice told me her son is Jason or Freddy, yet to be determined.
Although, I guess if you're dressed like one of the Mets, that counts as being kind of a dead person.
Oh, my God. So, I think we need to do better with candy. I mean, these people just everybody is serving the same candy, and it makes me sick. M&M's, Babe Ruth's, you know, Reese's Pieces. I'm like, can't anyone do something original with the candies they give?
Well, first of all, you're not supposed to do homemade stuff because that freaks people out. So I think you have, and kids get excited. It's their favorite one. They hoard it for like months.
I don't feel like homemade candy is going to fly. You are, when you trick or treat, you're like, they have peanut butter cups. And that house is out first. But when I grew up, it was razor blades and apples. And then there was like a myth of someone putting
poison tattoos.
Poison tattoos. And then LSD on postage stamps. Like the fear, you know? So nobody likes homemade stuff at all.
That was no myth. That was my house. And insecticide and candy corn, I just heard, too. That was a new one I didn't even know about. But there's been no documented instances of any of these things. But I'll tell you what, if you come to my house, we always go to Economy Candy and we buy chocolate eyeballs.
Good.
And they make severed fingers. And we really make an effort, you know? And no costume. No candy at my house.
Denise and I are going to come trick or treat.
You're scarred for life then.
Severed ears.
I like that the only vetting process. The only vetting process to give candy. The only vetting process to give candy out is to decorate your door. That's all. If you decorate your door, you can deal with
children.
Well,
apartment buildings in New York City, there's sort of this, I mean, sometimes the building tells you, but it's like if you have something decorative hung on your door, it means children are welcome. And if you have nothing, it's like those are the creepy, mean people who either aren't home or just don't want us to ring the bell.
Kids don't care. Kids just care about candy. It's the adults who go crazy about this stuff.
Yeah.
Seriously. No.
What do you guys do at Bread and Life for Halloween?
Just don't take candy away from the kids.
We're having a pre-Halloween party on the 30th, actually, because we have evening pantry on that day. So we have a digital food pantry where people can shop. So we'll tend to get a lot of families Tuesday evenings. So we're going to have a pre-Halloween party because it's also a great opportunity for kids to be able to use their costume another day. They're costly and they're just another fun opportunity for us to do something. So we're going to have a photo booth, candy. We're going to create our own snacks, you know, kind of like cup of dirt with pudding and crushed Oreos and worms.
Worms,
like
for
so
sure.
It's going to be really fun. That's going to be 3 to 5 on the 30th.
So
oh, very
fun.
Cool.
And at St. John's Bread and Life.
Well, I hope some of the candy is original candy because it's not just about filling your basket to the max and being like, no one wants to trade. When you have little amounts of different candies and eyeballs,
you also
and
trade
fingers.
With your friends. All right. The answer to your question is I like Twix. That's my favorite.
It's so boring. We give Ring Pops out, which is not a real epiphany by any means, but at least you only get one. And we write a sign. We say, if you take one more than one, we're going to kill you.
You're the sticky house.
The sticky house. No, it's cool. They love it. The kids are like, oh, we got one Ring Pop. And they have like literally 1,100 M&Ms. It's like, it's awesome.
Ask Sorrow, is there a traditional candy in Italy?
C'è Halloween nell'Italia, dove la gente mettono le vestiti?
Sì.
Sì?
La fanno tipo Stati Uniti.
Yeah, they do it just like the United States, he says.
Cool. All right, I'm going to move on to a favorite subject of all of ours in the room, Golden Girls. Noam, we got anything? All right, Golden Girls has been off the air for 26 years.
Thank you for
here we go.
Friend.
We got the theme music for everybody. All right, it's been off the air for 26 years, although reruns are on all the time. Mm-hmm. But damn if Dorothy, Blanche, Sophia, and Rose still don't have some pull. Pop culture company Funko recently released a Funko's Golden Girls cereal at select Targets, and people can't get enough of it. According to USA Today, the cereal itself is a multi-grain blue loop, but the real attraction is that every $8 box comes with a different Golden Girls Funko figurine. People have taken to tweeting at Target to track down boxes of the cereal while on eBay, boxes of the breakfast food are being auctioned for as much as $24, a triple markup. But also a small price to pay for being a pal and a confidant.
Well, I would want Rue McCallahan, Blanche DeVoe, va-va-voom. She was the real, sexy lady of the group. But man, Bea Arthur has got to be one of the funniest broads of all time.
No, you want to be Betty White. She's 96. Betty White. She's still alive. Just think of what she's making in terms of money.
I guess she can afford the $24 figurine of herself, but I love her. And
Betty
she
White
is.
Rocks, totally. Yeah. But whatever happened to like a Dakota ring or something cool? I mean, who are people who want like dolls of the Golden Girls in their cereal? That doesn't strike anybody as weird. Like, you know, I mean, did you ever get a prize? You young people, do you remember prizes in cereal boxes?
I think we had them in Lucky Charms, but they might have been paper at that point.
You were like, you know, know, or when Cracker Jacks had quality prizes in them.
Yeah.
Like, you'd open it up and you'd get, like, a harmonica in there or something, you know? And now it's like, you know, it's like...
No, they're like tattoo. Paper trivia games. Or, it's got LSD on it.
A poison tattoo.
Yeah, poison tattoo. Well, the Golden Girls are great. Man, that show was really progressive. I mean, people still talk about it. Also, people know all the character names and all the actor names. I mean, okay, this is a question. Bea Arthur, Dorothy's husband.
Stanley.
It was great. It was great. Now food, you know, was what not I do a in big part. Time. Is Estelle Getty still alive?
I don't even think of it as being off the air. It's so present and on the air.
Food was a big part, actually, because whenever they had their issues and troubles, they always got together for cheesecake.
Oh,
which is like a really true, typical girlfriend experience, whether you live together or not. Like, let's get together, let's hash it all out, let's bring everybody through the mud and do it over some cheesecake.
I actually own the Golden Girls Clue, and it's about who ate the last piece of cheesecake.
Oh, wow.
And Golden Girls also, in the beginning, they had the guy who cooked for them was gay. Like, they were so progressive, it wasn't just about, like, their various issues of, like, we're women who are 60 and working and still going on dates. They had, like, a huge gay character in the beginning during the AIDS crisis.
Interesting. I didn't know that. But they, I will say, gay men especially love the Golden Girls.
Well, remember there was a Rue McClanahan's best friend who she left everything to, gay best friend, had opened a very short-lived Golden Girls restaurant in Washington Heights. And it was like, what are they serving? It's like wraps and soup and salad and
we
cheesecake.
Covered it on one of our first episodes.
Really?
That it opened and then closed. I mean, it was, I think it was called Ruse or something. It was named after her.
And it was like everything she had left and you're like, and cheesecake.
The first gay guy I encountered on a sitcom was Too Close for Comfort. The guy, they had a neighbor who had come up, Jim J. Bullock or something like that. So, anyway, enough of that.
Enough? All right, we're going to move on to serious topics, although I like the Golden Girls better. So last week, Eater published a pro-McDonald's piece by a journalist who called slow food elitist and said that the slow food movement doesn't speak to her generation at all. I know a bunch of you read the article. There's a lot of different feelings about this.
So, Tyron, Mike, you want to start?
Well, this is like, you know, getting right into your wheelhouse, Patrick. You know, you're all up in arms about this. I mean, listen, the woman who wrote this is a great writer, and you didn't leave her name here on the cheat sheet. I gotta look it up. Suzanne Zupello, she's an excellent writer. She's a real journalist. She's not some cranky millennial.
Was this an op-ed of hers then? There's no journalism.
Well, listen,
she,
from what I understand, is like, you know, she was part of a sort of like kind of a save the world policy postgraduate program. She worked with on microloans in Africa. I mean, her heart's in the right place, but she's really wrong about this.
She is really wrong about this. First of all, fast food corporations are getting rich. You know, by selling pretty low quality food, which, by the way, I like the taste. I mean, I had a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich today, and God knows where that bacon came from. It's fine.
A cruel system.
But to write an op-ed criticizing a movement that's about reacquainting people with regional cuisines and preserving endangered ingredients, you don't want to come out with an op-ed against that. Can you name me a rich small farmer? Can you go to the green market and find me a rich farmer?
But
they don't exist. They're struggling too. So actually, if you're really about anti-elitism,
the only rich ones are the ones who do it as a hobby and maybe have about 4 potatoes to sell.
Well, I was going to say it's the corporate farmers that are rich.
Sure.
And they get rich by providing bad food to the poor. Meanwhile, the very small farms that provide excellent food to the rich stay very poor.
Well, I think this story is more about the orthodoxy of slow food and people take, you know, somewhat of a very pedantic, you know, dogmatic, bordering on fascist look at like what you're allowed to put in your mouth. I mean, that's what she's talking about here, that the restaurants that she worked on were all about education and you couldn't stray off the path. You know, to eat McDonald's. And listen, we wrote a book largely about slow food, you and I, Patrick. And what do we say? Like, to every life, a few Oreos must fall. And you talk about eating your bacon, egg, and cheese. And
you were talking about what? Malamar's, your favorite.
And White Castle. I mean, listen, I like not to eat processed food. You know, in an ideal hippie utopia, I suppose everything would be grown locally. But also, as you talk about, local is not gastronomy, it's geography. And not everything I want is going to be grown within a short radius.
So what do you guys think of running the largest hunger relief organization in Brooklyn about elitism, food, quality, all that?
Good. I mean, I read this article, and And I've worked as a cook. I am a cook. And when you're a line cook, sometimes on your day off, you're like, I want an Egg McMuffin because it is good. But it's about a question of like political money of supporting systems and individual, like what you like to eat. And every cook likes to be like, likes to think that they're really living on some edge for being like, I like White Castle. You're not living on some edge. You like something that has been created so that you love it and crave it. It's like science. But elitism in food and like, we live in Brooklyn, you know, we're on a block across from us is a drug rehab center and there's brownstones that sell for millions of dollars on the same block. Mm-hmm. That I think that, I don't know, you don't want me to talk about this forever, but like people who come to us, some who are our guests a lot of the times and like see that elitism. They see sort of like healthy food as being like white food and as being something that won't taste good. That's like part of it. But when you make good food, you just make good food. And I think for us, it's about opening up the systems of how to distribute the food, how to get it, and how to teach people. It's a luxury to teach someone how to break down giant cases of vegetables or meat so that you can use it. So, but it's an important education that we're so far away from. God, what was the beginning of this question?
All right. So Caroline, sister, or Al, you
go. Ahead, Al.
I'm going to skip the elitism argument, but the three things we know through experience with people that we serve, one, they eat what they can afford.
Mm-hmm.
So bad food, McDonald's is affordable, whether we want to get into that debate or not. Second thing, they will eat what is closest to them. So you could put up a White Castle way quicker than you could put up a farm.
Mm-hmm.
So the corporations are at a big advantage. I could put up 100 White Castles before I can make one farm. And then that proximity is that by the time the food gets to here, people are already eating at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. But mostly we find that people eat what they can afford mm-hmm. and what's close. It's the way they shop, too. When they go to pantries, they come to us because, first, we're closest to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll go further out to another pantry. But it's a convenience model, and it's an affordability model.
But you guys have put effort to bucking that system of the lowest quality food. You put real effort into making it the highest quality food.
Oh, we do, because you have to make the effort, but you're running uphill against this,
sure.
You know, pretty much.
Sister Carolyn, what do you say?
Well, I think Al's right. You know, one of the things that a lot of people struggle with, especially now with gentrification, and as Millicent said, you know, on our block, we have million-dollar homes, we have a drug rehab, and then there's us. So people make choices about what they can and can't afford. So if they can come to us and get some stuff, and they may choose, you know, White Castle, Burger King, whatever it is, because it is convenient, you know. And if somebody's living in a shelter or, you know, they don't always have, you know, the availability. It's easy. It's quick. And, I mean, I have to say, I'm not somebody who really cooks at all. And if I sometimes have a choice, that's the easiest thing, you know, mm-hmm. and it's not always the healthiest. It's not always the best, but it's a choice you make. So, you know, to get people to think differently is really hard,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's what we're really striving to do is to even myself change the way I think about food.
And that's why that op-ed by that lady for Eater was not appealing to me. You don't need to come out. That's like Kanye West coming out pro Trump. I'm like, why go there, dude? Like, just you can be pro him if you want, you know, do your thing. But you don't have to try to change maybe 100 years of your people's relationship to government and stuff like that. And likewise, you don't come and shit on the slow food. That really bothered me. And it doesn't need an article criticizing it. It needs to be embraced. Just it might need to change and it might need to do a better job, but you don't criticize it. No one is more criticized in the food world than Alice Waters. And all she's trying to do is promote organic food and no GMOs. I'm like, leave the lady alone. It's a great message. She's trying her best.
Well, I think what this address is also, is she says, Suzanne Zuppello, again, the writer, says it's cult-like. Slow food. And I put the onus, though, that on the people who are promoting slow food that way, that there really is this hardcore orthodoxy to it, because there shouldn't be. I mean, yeah, you do eat what's closest, and you should. I'd like it if everybody, you know, didn't walk by the, you know, the Burger King and weren't using their, you know, food stamps, they're part of a TAR program, to buy Golden Girl cereal. You know, I'd hope they'd be buying fresh vegetables and, like, healthy staples. But that's not the case, and I think the answer is education. But on the side of the slow food people, too, Patrick, when, you know, when you go to a restaurant and everybody is so hardcore and uptight about it and pretending that they don't eat Malamars or White Castle, you know, it's kind of fucked up.
Yeah,
because
well.
Because we all do.
Yeah, no, I mean, I hear that, but.
I don't know, the line that resonated with me is also that we're saying that this is not, you know, speaking to the current generation and her generation. And I think that all the fast casual things that are popping up and that are becoming more convenient and that are going into different neighborhoods. And obviously there's a flow of which neighborhoods, you know, the Sweet Greens and the Diggins and all these, you know, energy kitchen type places are reaching. But they are pushing their way in, and there is this idea, obviously the price is higher, but you know, this idea that maybe you have three components of your meal for a set price of you know, $10. Millicent, I think you want to chime in.
Well, no, I mean, I guess I just don't, like, when you are in a restaurant, you're consumed by it. So you're consumed by what if this restaurant signs up for that. But I guess I just don't see it that way. And I think that people get consumed by their scenes and their communities. So, like, I don't see such a huge stratification of food. I feel like people are trying to find, like, more an even step of it, you know? And I get put off by elitism. I grew up on a farm. I grew up in a bar, you know? I get put off by elitism. I'm someone who's cooked for a long time before the food scene. But I think that there are people who are insane about what they put in their bodies, and they fear what will cross. And that's, like, so many issues. But the fast casual places are interesting. Education, like for us, we give out fruits and vegetables at least twice a week. And that's outside of any tract, like that's outside of our food pantry. That's just like, if you want this, take it. And, you know, we have a bunch of beets from the farmer's market. They're beautiful. But people are like, beets? And so you just write what's in them. I made up a sheet and it has like what nutrients and vitamins they have in them and the easiest way to make them, which I think is roasting. That makes them really delicious. And then that little bit of information helps people, mm-hmm. you know? And then so there's people who are bred in life who don't have that information and go with what they know. And then there's people probably with too much information who are like, I can only eat this thing that was planted in this soil. And then they go there.
Well, a lot of my things about elitism come to meat and, you know, cheap meat. I mean, we must strive to steer a little bit away from that. Those animals suffer. They grow too fast. They're obese. They are in confinement. They're not being allowed to enact their natural instincts. And so cheap meat is really the thing that bothers me. I think, you know, fruits, vegetables, that's a different story. That needs to be accessible to all people and all that. But, you know, the meat thing, I'm in the meat business. That really ticks me off when someone writes a pro article about Smithfield pigs. That just bothers me. So.
Do you guys find that you have I know we'll get to your more of the interview portion later, but do you find that there's a different sort of group of people who come for your prepared food versus the opportunity to shop in the pantry? And it's a different level of, I guess, interest or knowledge of how to cook?
So when you come into our dining room, and we serve two meals a day, breakfast and lunch, you will see that it tends to be a lot more men. It tends to definitely be, it can be an older group of people. When we're looking at people who are shopping in the pantry, that definitely tends to be a lot more families. So they're looking to be able to shop. We do have, essentially the way it works is that people come in and they shop online. They can shop in our facility online, or they can shop from their phone and pick out the food that they like. The fresh produce and bread that we are able to provide to them, they don't need any of their kind of pantry points to be able to shop for that. So it's first come, first served, and we try to do food demonstrations as well to show if I am in shelter or if I'm unstably housed, how do I take the fresh produce that I have along with the food that's offered in the pantry to try to make a meal out of what's given to me here? Because while, you know, people always are looking for more produce, more meat, we are also, you know, dealing with what we do have and within our limitations and to people's living situations. So sometimes a lot of our families aren't stably housed. Some entire families go home to home. They spend a few nights in different places, or they're losing their items because they're relocated out of shelter. So we tend to see that the people who are shopping in our pantry do tend to be families, although we do offer emergency bags, which are kind of just things you can pick up and go and take on the go with you as well.
Mm, very cool.
So well, you see the whole spectrum of the food sort of.
But one of the things, too, is we do like 3,000 meals a day, and it's all freshly prepared. The main meal is always freshly prepared. And I think people seek that out because mm-hmm. it is the only meal that they get. You know, it's unlike people who shop in the pantry. They're coming at times that are convenient for them. people who are in the dining room, I don't like to call it a soup kitchen,
right,
in the dining room, come because, you know, word of mouth says, oh, today they're having Heritage Farm lamb, you know, and people line up for that because it's something that they don't traditionally get or can't afford.
Right.
So we do try to do that stuff. And that's really critical to, you know, getting people in and saying, you know, there are different things that you can do, different ways to eat. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not forcing this on you.
Well, we're going to ask that in the interview part about the challenges of staying dynamic and how your chefs, you know, cook for so many people and all that. So, well, let's, this is my one to ask, you know, just transitioning and then we'll get to the interview. The Bible suggests 10% tithing. Is that right? That's what the Bible says. You should give 10%
okay,
of your...
Okay, take me out of the picture, but for everybody else, I guess that's correct.
How close are each of you to achieving that? Emily, Mike, I'll start
Well, I
with
think
you.
For a Heritage Foods employee, asking them to give $800 a year is out of the question.
Stop. So, but seriously, I mean, do you guys give 10%? What is what do you recommend to your children or your nephews or your aunts or uncles? What percentage of their... what do you even say, income, should they be giving to charity?
Well, not everybody can afford to do 10%, but what I would recommend is give 10% of your time. Mm-hmm. If you can't okay. give money, give time.
Well, that's a great. Mm-hmm. Well,
20% of your time. Maybe.
Yeah, no, it's true. So, I mean, most people don't give. I mean, I hear Tony used to say it was the poorest people that gave the most.
Yes.
And the
is.
Richest
it's very
people.
True. Yeah. You know, we have people who are transient, who may have no place to live. But when they're down in the dining room and somebody happens to be passing that says they don't have a coat, mm-hmm. you know, 10 minutes later, somebody who has no place to live shows up with a coat and says, here, mm-hmm. you know. I don't know how quick the rest of us would be to do something like that if we weren't working where we work, mm-hmm. to be honest. 10%, for some people, that's a lot of money. You know, let's be honest. It's, you know, it's what's advised, maybe. But I think if you give from the heart with a real conscious effort to say, I'm supporting this because I really believe in it and I want to be there, means more to me. I mean, we get people who send us a dollar a week or a dollar a month. That's just as important as somebody who may be able to give more.
It's what's significant.
Right. Yeah. It's significant to that person.
So what charities do you all support? I'll start. I do Heritage Radio, Bread and Life, Ann and I make a personal donation every year. And if I had to pick one nonprofit kind of out of that, well, we love the Good Food Awards. Heifer International, they give livestock to families in hard-up places, mm-hmm. and you get a male and a female goat, and you can start a farm and raise your own food. What charities do you guys support?
I don't know. I think it's something that I don't have a clear-cut answer.
You don't have a charity?
No, it's funny. No, I find that I think I'm sort of developing what I feel is like most important to me. And my husband and I are, you know, married 2 years. I think he has things he always gave to. I have programs that I've given to. And you're sort of reevaluating, like, as a family, like, where do you want to give your time? Where do you want to give your dollars? You know, I was raised Jewish. I would try to give to my synagogue, but it's one of those things they ask once a year versus my dad's not Jewish. We talked about growing up in church. They would pass a basket every week. So maybe you'd give $5 each week and you actually ended up giving way more than you might if you're being asked for an annual appeal to write a check once a year. I have schools that I went to that, you know, I want to give back to. So I find that then I have friends who, you know, are supporting multiple sclerosis and doing bike ride. At the end of the day, I've almost spread myself too thin to where I feel like my pennies don't count.
You've spread yourself too thin, but you still haven't given any money? What's going on
What
here?
Do you mean? I try to give to everybody. I think what I've come to realize is which one is what is it that I want to be supportive of with my okay. time rather than everybody else asking, can you give? Yeah. These are the things important to me.
All right. Well, someone name a charity.
I do think it's incumbent upon those of us who are fortunate to help people who are less fortunate. I do believe that. And, you know, it's the Jewish tradition of tzedakah, which I believe in. And I've been charity shopping, actually, because when Tony Butler was on here, it made a huge impression on me. The things he had to say about poverty and what it takes to get out of the middle class. I mean, he really, really left a very strong...
And how
strong,
quickly regular people when he said
it takes like 20 years of everything going right to climb out of poverty and into the middle class, and that means no traumatic medical situations. It means not losing your job for an extended period of time, no auto accident. I mean, like any millions of things that prevent you from climbing up to the next strata, you know, socioeconomically. I mean, that really made a difference. Anyway, I've been kind of looking, you know, at charities, sort of trying to figure it out.
And so Mike and
I I have a large network on Facebook and social media, and I've seen people whose lives have been devastated by, you know, like medical trauma, and they just can't dig out of it. Their houses fall down. I mean, like things happen to people. Good things.
Patrick doesn't like any of our answers.
I mean, let me tell you something, Patrick. Heritage Radio,
a
not-for-profit is not a charity. Heritage Radio, though, even though you get to write it off on your taxes, is not a charity. The Museum of Modern Art is not a charity. And giving giving to your school, schools have so much money. You paid $190,000 to get that degree. Do you want to give them more money after that?
Okay, well, I mean, that's nuts. Both your guys' answers support what my point was going to be, is that today's generation of people support stuff through what they like on Facebook, what they like on Instagram. It doesn't really do it. I say, I don't mean this negative towards you guys. If my kids are 30 years old and cannot just name the three charities that they support mm-hmm. once a year, I'll have felt like something's wrong in the world. But I know most things are like this. Most people are like this. It is the way of the world. But I think what we need to do to create change is that people say, I am going to give $500. And I do think that the Carnegie Hall is okay. It could be your school.
The aristocracy of like, oh, I gave to the Metropolitan Opera this year can support what's basically an unpopular art form that needs rich people to prop it up.
That's
not a charity.
Okay, so then bread and
life. In what ways is that a charity? Versus like me sending to like a GoFundMe for a friend of mine who's got cancer and has no health insurance. You know, and also I think charity should be anonymous, so I'm already talking too much because that's the tradition of tzedakah. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to virtue signal by telling you who I give money to.
Well, don't worry.
I throw money at the ACLU every year too, but it's not a fucking charity.
All right.
That is a fair point about the idea of understanding what is important to each of us, and some people it's the arts. I don't know. So to answer your question, Brooklyn Youth Sports Club.
Okay.
It's a non-for-profit here in Brooklyn that fuels kids to focus on tutoring and applying to college and doing their homework through basketball as a focus. And they do after-school programming and they help kids with SAT prep and everything like that. So my friend started it 8 years ago, and I support him every single year.
That's fantastic.
And then Michigan hits me up every year, and I went there and I love it. And I'm like, well, you don't need my money, but okay, I'll give you a little.
So what do you guys? Do you guys support anyone other than Bread and Life? I mean, do you feel mm-hmm. pushed to give $50, $100, $500 mm-hmm. in December to other charities or to your own?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
I mean, as a religious, we don't get in a lot of money. We get a very small stipend every month. But each of us makes a contribution to things that, like you said, hit home. For me, it would be the American Cancer Society. It's education. I was on a board for 20 years of a nonprofit that worked with kids who all of their families were they were all immigrant families. They're just learning to adjust, you know. So, you know, that was important to me. Education's important to me. But what we do at Bread and Life is significant because it reaches so many more people. Mm-hmm. And I can see where my money goes. I see where that value is. Mm-hmm. You know, I learned as a little kid. My grandparents had a bakery and a restaurant. From the time I was little, they would give without thinking, you know, and it was to anyone who needed it. So it wasn't just that, you know, you pick out a charity. It's acting in the need, you know, responding to that need. And, you know, it could be anything, you know, and your needs change. And people's you know, likes and dislikes change. You know, I would think that in 20 years, I would hope I would still be committed. But who knows? You know, I might have a different focus.
That's like exactly what Patrick is saying, though. It's things that we are liking, things that are right in our face, things that we're connected to. So I know, I mean, although I do donate to the Alzheimer's Association because my father mm-hmm. had Alzheimer's, my father-in-law has Alzheimer's. I also am connected to the Black Six Project, which does provide on the relief ground, you know, in Puerto Rico and other countries when there are serious, you know, situations that are happening, as well as Tent Ministries, which is located here in Bushwick, and they're constantly having different types of, you know, coat drives, and mm-hmm. We've worked with them a little bit through St. John's Bread and Life, and to be honest, you know, we had this very small connection with them. They did a coat drive. I attended an event. They donated 26 bags of coats to us, to our clients. It saved our entire year last year for people mm-hmm. who were in need of those items.
Al?
Yes, sir.
Who do you get?
He's like, I don't know if I want to stick my neck out here.
St. John's is a very, I mean, the Catholic faith does do a tremendous amount of work. I mean, they have got great basketball programs because they reach out to these inner city communities and create spaces for them. I mean, it's a basic group. St. John's itself has been built by St. John's, right?
The university.
Yes, even though they're less and less, they're able to help us. They're having their own problems. But I do give to Bread and Life, and I do give to, I would say, spontaneous giving. I think people do get overwhelmed, and this is where social media comes in again. There are so many things to give to, and you're also bombarded to give so much. So sometimes it's like deer in the headlights, as you were saying earlier. Mm-hmm. Well, what do I give to here? Then there's this cynicism that older donors, like myself, I think we get sometimes, of not knowing if your money really gets to where it's supposed to go. I mean, that sounds like a cop-out. For me, I'd rather do something tangible. I'd rather do what I do a lot when I go on the subway. If somebody is sitting there, you know, and needs money, I'll give the change. Mm-hmm. And I'll do that, like, quite often, like, without judging, because I know the money is going exactly to somebody. So I do think, yes, if I send $500 to this refund, mm-hmm. like in another country, you know, what happens, you know, once it gets out of my hands? It's unfortunate to think that way, but I'd rather do something tangible where I could see it.
I think it also works with, like, donating coats, you know, donating, you know, we do make some meat donations, having gatherings where people all contribute something.
Yeah.
Around the holidays, I think you guys also collect, you know, canned items to be able to distribute. So I think that when you're also actually doing it, and it's not the same way personally on the subway, I'll always give food. Always give someone a piece of food. You know, I'm more likely to do that and to witness someone take it or to see that they feel a sense of relief than maybe to give a few dollars.
Okay.
I agree with that spontaneous giving. Just to clarify, though, when I said I was charity shopping, though, because it is important to know, like, that administration costs aren't ridiculously high. But then when you look at some of these more famous charities and, you know, the Red Cross is, of course, notorious for it, but the American Cancer Society. I mean, everybody has administration costs, and you want to look at what their operating budgets are. And if someone has a $1 billion operating cost, I don't know that my $25 contribution is going to make a difference. Whereas if I give it directly to, like, y'all, or I can give you some coats, or I can give them my time, or a friend who I see is really in need, you know, cutting, you know, it goes directly to help someone to put some food on the table.
So we're going
to
take a break. By the way, I was coming off all holier than thou when I was like, someone said, what if you win the lotto? $1 billion. I'm like, I would probably give, how much spontaneous giving would you give of that? I was like,
it'd,
I don't know, 20
so
million.
Much.
And
so
they
much.
Were like, you
10%.
So much. It would be so much fun.
$400.
When I cook, sometimes I have a private chef job, and like, it's sometimes it's on, like, there's one that's on Christmas, and I'll like take a portion of that money and get fives and just like walk through the subway and be like, here.
Can I work some of the events with you? So I know.
those moments, I talk about this with my mom all the time. If I won the lotto, I know we have to go to break. Well, who would you give to? It would make everything.
I
make
hope
you
I
feel...
would get something. $1 billion. I'm asking for $10,000.
Charity starts at home, Em.
It does. All right. If I
when I say home, I mean here at Heritage Radio.
Apparently, somebody won in South Carolina or something.
Yeah.
For the record, yeah, one person.
Hopefully, they're listening and they know that they
should
start here.
At home. By the way, that was funny the way that went. I'm like, name your guys' as charities, and they're like, I'm shopping for a charity.
It's very hard, and then as all of you answer, I'm like, oh, I also.
What was that?
This is important.
After listening to Tony, I was like looking at like Habitats for Humanity and other, you know, like,
well,
you know, name
break.
Brand
let's
charities and deciding, you know, where maybe I should, because I do think it's important that we help
but
people who
are
less fortunate.
There's a website that you can check.
That's right. There's a charity.
And I think some of those older places are more, sometimes they're not lean. They're not running lean.
They're pushing us to break. We'll
break
be back with the main
minute.
Course.
Jimmy Carter seems nice.
Really talk interview with you guys.
To my surprise. He did the Monster Mash.
The Monster Mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight.
All right, we're back. This is the Main Course OG, airing live from Roberta's here in Bushwick, Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. We seem to have some whispers over that away. All right, we are here in studio with our guests from St. John's Bread and Life, a hunger and poverty relief organization here in Brooklyn. So we have here Sister Caroline, Millicent, Al, Janice. See, I got everyone's names. We know that you guys provide millions of healthy, nutritious meals each year through your culinary arts program. How is it that you can feed 850,000 meals while still focusing, or sorry, people, I saw on your website, while still focusing on sustainability and nutrition? Something we were talking a little bit about before.
I mean, Heritage donates meat to us, and we do a lot of rescue cuisine, and we're looking more at that, and so that's picking up, like, food that's on its way out but still has a life and needs to be utilized, and we get from City Harvest. So we really push on vegetables. We work on, like, we have HipNap that we have to adhere to, that's like low sodium, low fat, like, so it's like, how do you make delicious food like that? And we have a kitchen full of people who, like, know how to cook. Like, if you've ever had Ronnie's meatloaf, it is incredible. Really delicious. And then there's moments where, like, there, like, for World Hunger Day, we had barbecue chicken, we had lamb ribs, and there's a line around the block. So when everybody can cook, like, what they want to cook, they're making really delicious food.
How big is your team on the culinary side to feed that many people each year?
Not big at all. We have 2 full-time cooks. And then we have 2 people who work in our kitchen who do an assorted array of things. And then we have lots and lots of volunteers, you know. So we couldn't do it without the volunteers. But our kitchen staff, our kitchen crew is phenomenal. You know, I mean, I walk in there and they have everything, like, go in. And they start at, like, 6 o'clock. And by 8:30, breakfast is out and they're already into lunch already. And they move. You know, it's like clockwork and teamwork, and that's real important.
And they cook on trucks, right, going around,
right,
too.
We have a mobile unit that goes out and does between 600 and 700 meals a day. So once the meals are completed, that gets loaded up into the truck, and then our MSK, which is the mobile unit, goes out to different areas, different communities, where people really are, like, underserved, mostly seniors, some poor working families.
And your first responders, right? Hurricane Sandy, you guys were the first ones out.
Yeah, we did a lot for Hurricane Sandy, and Al can speak to that. And, you know, we work with the Red Hook Justice Center. When they see an emergency food need, they call us, and we can respond. So, you know, we do that.
Is your mobile unit going into the same communities? Is it something that's announced in advance? Do you go to anyone's homes and drop off food?
No, we don't drop off food. What we do is we have sites that are published, and people kind of know that in the community when to expect us. It's on our website. You know, we're constantly updating that. And we go to communities where people have called us and said there is a need. So we try to respond to the people's need. Mm-hmm. It's not where we think we should go. It's where the need is.
Wow. That's fantastic. And then how do your chefs keep things dynamic and interesting? You know, where do you, we talked a little bit about where you source some of your food from, but, you know, who's cooking, but, like, who qualified?
Because Tony once asked us to bring, if chefs did an event, like a fundraising event, that they would stay and work with the team there for maybe a creative way to extend a vegetable over more portions or add flavors.
Also, it's very different to cook in quantity.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tilt skillet and a giant kettle that's mainly being used in convection ovens. The menu changes, and it changes also because of seasons, and it changes because of what's on hand. And we had a meeting about this yesterday of sort of what we need to do to have more hands-on vegetables that we're getting and utilize more rescue cuisine because it's available for us. Then it means we can feed more people. Like, we send out also, other than MSK, we send out meals to seniors. You know, people call and they're like, we need food. And we're like, okay, great. We'll send it to you. So if we can utilize more and more of rescue cuisine, which also helps on so many ends, then we can do that. But we do have, you know, we have Mabel and Kenny, we have Argo and Tim in the kitchen, and we have volunteers. And like those volunteers have a wide range of skills sets, you know, and some people are people you're like, all right, you don't have any knife skills. So I'm not going to pretend like you're going to have knife skills. Like people want there to be this like super cool restaurant-y baller answer of like, I'm going to go in there and make this great meal. And it's like, well, we need that every day. And we have like Millie's group of kids who come who are like amazing, but they're not necessarily going to peel and cut down a butternut squash, but we need them and they need us. So we're looking at like how to utilize more and more vegetables. And then because then for everybody, it's going to be the time when maybe they eat eggplant and then they aren't like, what the hell is this? And then they'll pick it up in pantry, you know? So we're pushing on that like right now.
So, but you guys do other things, right? From housing assistance to medical care, legal counseling, nutrition education. You do more than just feed the community. So can you guys speak to that?
Yeah, so we also have a social services department where we really kind of look at the family holistically. We try to ensure that a lot of our families are multi-generational. So we'll see within the household we have parents, you know, with grandparents and children in the household. We do have a baby program where we're able to provide things like diapers and infant formula on a monthly basis to families. We have women's groups and men's group. We have a crochet film and reflection group that happen throughout the week. In addition, we do have those other services. We have legal
voter
services.
Registration is a great
voter
one.
Registration right now. And things like immigration services, they're there once a week, legal services. But our team, which also consists of volunteers and interns, as well as case managers, they're very well versed. Some of them have been case managers at Bread and Life for 10 years, 14 years. Mm-hmm. So people in the community really view them as a staple. They may come and just say, can you read this mail to me? They may sit there and, you know, wait that time to be able, because they have a connection with them directly, mm-hmm. to be able to do so. We're always looking to expand on our program, so we do lots of different surveying, mm-hmm. asking our clients what it is that they're looking for, which is how the women's group has grown.
Well, I love you guys pioneered the whole choice thing, you know, that computer program that allows the kids to choose. So, you know, you're not getting your third Barbie doll or you know, Barbie doll if you're a boy or something. You're actually able to go and pick. So it really is about dignity. And I think that's a really cool thing. I know you guys work with, I think, IBM, right, to pioneer this way of doing charity.
Well, IBM was helping us with what they called their supply chain model. They were analyzing the way we did things, and then they found out that we did it so well that they were going to make a model out of it. Mm-hmm. So we're jumping into Sponsor Family, I'm guessing?
Yeah,
go for it.
All right, so Sponsor Family is a idea that we adopted from another organization back in 1997. Some church was doing it on a very small scale, maybe 100 families. So we adopted that model back then, since we had more staff, and we did it with 700 families. So the idea, and the key word was dignity, the idea was for a family to have food and toys that they can enjoy in the dignity of their own homes, mm-hmm. that they didn't have to go to some shelter and eat there or what have you. So that was the origins of it. Today we're doing 2,000 families, and across every borough except Staten Island. Sorry, Staten Islanders. So we do 1,200 locally, 1,200 families local, and then we do 800 across shelters and other organizations. So what do these families get? They get the opportunity to pick their toys. And what we did is we took the food pantry model and we substitute food with toys. Mm-hmm. So just like they could pick a banana, we found a way, well, they could pick a Barbie doll. So they're able to come in and choose the toys that they want. And of course, we would have purchased the toys already. So we already have them in inventory. Then there is the food aspect, which to the parents is more important than the toys. So on average, that food package is about 30 to 35 pounds, which includes the ham and the brisket that we get from you guys. Mm-hmm. A vegetable pack. It's enough food to sustain a family of four for 5 days. Wow. So that's the way we measured it. And what we do is we'll take one food package and we and we will weigh it, and we'll count down all of the servings that are in it, so we know to a degree how much food we're giving out. So we've been doing this for since 1997, more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. And people who want to join that program, since we're promoting it, would need to come to Bread and Life on any Saturday up until November and need to sign up. They have to do it in person.
Well, very, very, very impressive. I mean, you guys, it's like so much more real when we interview you guys. I mean, I love all our interviews, but there's something so real about this. Caroline, we only have a couple minutes left, and I want to ask Sato one question about what an Italian would cook if he had to cook for 850,000 people. But I'm going to ask you, adesso ti chiedo. But can you tell me, you just became the executive director. What are your greatest challenges? I mean, it must be like holding a tiger by its tail.
No. I think it's great to work with like people who are so super committed, because even though it's really hard to raise money, 90% of what we do is privately supported. So we have to go out and shake hands and make friends and, you know, engage people. And one of the ways I like to do it is get people in to volunteer. Because if you see it and you have the experience, then you're more likely to say, I know that my $10 or my $50 is supporting five people or six people. And there are lots of people who need to do that and feel committed to that. That's a challenge. That's a challenge to get people in the door. The other challenge is, you know, sustainability. Yeah, we want people to feel, you know, everything that they eat or get from Bread and Life is healthy. It's good. It's a positive influence. It's helping to change their lives in a better direction.
How much money do you have to raise in a calendar year, ballpark?
About $4 million. You know.
Wow. How do people give to Bread and Life?
You can give to Bread and Life through your check, your money order, cash. Online at breadandlife.org. We do online giving. Sponsor a family is another way to support the organization, which turns around and supports the community. One of the things that we didn't say is that what we do is we want to companion with people. That's what makes us different. You know, people come to us, we want to give hope, or we want to keep the hope alive, and we want people to feel empowered to be their best selves. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you do for them and not show them, there's a big difference in that, you know. So everybody who comes in, they get the tour. They meet everybody. They know who's doing what by name. And I think that makes a significant difference when you're looking to give to a charity, you know. Do we have to raise money? Absolutely. It's my biggest challenge. But
you're like us, Heritage Foods. Once you taste the food, you become a convert,
exactly,
even if it's expensive.
Exactly.
So once you meet the people.
Once you meet the people, you know, and come. You know, like we each all eat in the dining room at some point. People know who we are. We know people. We can walk through the community. People all know us, you know, so that's a big difference. So the challenge is, you know, we got to get out there and shake hands and make people aware of what we do. And, you know, Bed-Stuy, Bushwick, East New York, the neighborhoods are changing. We want to be friends with everybody. We want everybody to participate in what we do. So if you want to volunteer, nice, you can give us a call.
You got Noam to do a sound effect. Wow. You
thanks, Noam. Yeah. We like that.
You know. Noam and them have a family friend in common.
That's not a charitable contribution, Noam. You can't write sound effects off on your
own. Step in the right direction.
So, Sado, se tu dovevi cucinare per 800,000 persone, cosa servirei?
Una cucina da campo per 10,000 persone.
Sì? Campo?
Una cucina da campo.
Okay.
10,000 militari.
Ma cosa ma... Oh, he used to cook for the military, so he did great things.
Oh, wow.
He also cooks with anchovies, which is, if more people ate anchovies, it's the cheapest fish in the world. Yeah. But just the thought of it doesn't appeal to people, so they don't eat anchovies. But if people ate it, and if they ate grasshoppers and insects and stuff like that, like we ate a claro, it's the cheapest food in the world.
Questi stanno chiedendo, ma questo italiano che non capisce niente, che ci sta a fare qua?
He's like, everyone's
però,
asking, what the hell is this guy doing
c'è
here? But there is a motive.
Non capisco l'inglese.
He does understand.
Ma ho capito una cosa qui.
And he understood one thing in New York.
Il cibo, the heritage food.
Heritage foods.
Che è veramente eccellente.
Is very excellent.
Che ho cucinato carne di capra.
He's cooked it 100 times, goat.
Una meraviglia. E... è un gusto bellissimo.
Bellissimo. So he's a big fan of heritage breeds.
Perciò,
and he
non
thinks...
è che anche nei ristoranti. Eh?
Yes,
nei ristoranti
also
che chiedo se c'hanno la carne di Heritage Food. Altrimenti.
Eat the best meat or no meat at all is his message. So he's not just a goon. I mean, he has a message. He's got to promote Heritage Foods.
We should have run that instead of our sponsor ad. You know.
Grazie, Sado. Well, thank you to everybody. Mike?
I think, you know, it's important to say, though, we've sort of come around here. We're starting to talk about slow food and, you know, and this journalist who kind of wrote about it like it was like Scientology or some cult. Mm-hmm. And we're talking to these wonderful people from Bread and Life who are feeding really good, nutritious, healthy, fresh farmed food to people, and there's nothing elite about that.
Yeah.
There's nothing elite about it at all.
Slow food is a much bigger thing than her buddy at that restaurant. Slow food is a movement the way woman suffrage,
was a woman
environmentalism.
She wanted to eat a Big Mac and not like a bowl of sprouts.
I understand. Well, Al Diffenbach, Millicent Cerise, Sister Caroline Tweedy, thank you so much, and Janice Acevedo. Emily Pearson, Noam, Sara DiLiberto, Brandon Hoy, Mike
Brandon,
Edison.
Who was here briefly. Stick around for Tech Bites at 11, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks
for joining us.
Thank you.
You women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style. Moving all along.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.